Devoncast
from Radio X.
Devoncast returns with your weekly roundup of Devon's top stories. I'm Guy Henderson, and I'm joined in the studio today not only by my colleague Paul Nero, but also by our special guest Steve Race, the Labour MP for Exeter. Welcome, Steve. Nice to have you along.
Nice to see you too.
Steve worked as a senior researcher for long-serving Exeter MP Ben Bradshaw before taking the plunge himself and contesting the East Devon seat in 2015 when Hugo Swire won for the Conservatives. With the retirement of Ben Bradshaw at the 2024 general election, Steve's time had come and he swept in with a 12,000 majority. On the doorsteps, he said he would fight for a fair and inclusive Exeter and do what he could about people's problems getting a dentist, getting a reliable bus service and getting timely treatment in hospital. And we'll find out how that fight's going on in a minute. Also coming up on this Devoncast, we talk about bad behaviour in the council chamber, the start of a new railway project in Okehampton, and there's a riddle over a planning decision that's got a few people scratching their heads in East Devon. But first, Exeter's Labour MP Steve Race. Welcome, Steve. Nice to have you along. It's been 8 months or thereabouts since you were elected, and this is the first time we've been able to get you here for a chat. We know you've been really busy because we see the email alerts every time you get up to speak or to submit a question. What have you been up to on behalf of the City of Exeter? How's it going?
Thanks very much. I've had a pretty busy 8 months. I think when you start as a MP, even though I took over from Ben, who is also a Labour MP, you still have to set up your own office, and I took all of his team on, but everything is still new. So we had a bit of time setting everything up, and we've had a huge amount of incoming emails from Exeter residents that we've been getting back to as well, and obviously new Labour government finding its feet, which is fantastic. So in terms of things I've been doing for Exeter, I've been getting around the city, meeting lots of people, getting to meet lots of the organisations, but we've had some real successful wins as well, which is great. So I've been lobbying the ICB on the NHS Devon, the ICB, on a range of issues and had some good successes out of that, including on cataracts operations and on hospice funding as well. So really pleased. I think we're going to talk about dentistry and waiting lists later on, but I've just been fighting the corner for Exeter for the last 8 months.
But dentistry and waiting lists and what have you, that was part of your website. I had a look on your website as well. That was one of the things that you said that you were going to tackle. Have you had any successes on that? Because that really is the phrase that we use, a wicked issue for people in Exeter, people in Devon in general.
Yeah, I agree. Devon and Exeter in particular is a real sort of NHS dentist desert, really. And if you talk to Wes Streeting, he'll know that that's the case. I mean, at him for the last 8 months about it. Really pleased that a couple of weeks ago announced that 25,000 new urgent dentistry appointments have been funded for the next year for Devon. So that's an extra 25,000 appointments on the NHS that we wouldn't have had otherwise. We've also got the teeth brushing programme being rolled out into primary schools, which is really good. But I've also been lobbying again, NHS Devon, because they have something around like a £13 million underspend on dentistry. So they've got the money. What they need to do, and what I've been asking them to do, is slightly provide some flexibility in the contract so they can get that money out into the system.
25,000 appointments on the NHS sounds a lot, Steve. But what do people actually need to do if they want one of those free appointments?
So these are specifically urgent care appointments. So it's if you've got a specific problem and there's a portal to go through for this. So it's not fundamentally changing the system, which is what we do need and which is what comes next.
So, if you've got toothache tonight and it's really painful.
Exactly.
You're okay.
You'll be able to apply for one of the. You'll be able to sort of try and get one of the emergency appointments. So there's some already that you can get. There's a finite number, and we're adding 25,000 into that. What needs to happen next, though, and if you talk to the dentists, this is what they want to see is contract reform. Because basically, the reason that the dentists have withdrawn from NHS services is that the contract does not pay them enough to make it worth their while. And so that's what comes next on the government. So I know that's what Stephen Kinnock, who's the care minister in charge of dentistry, is now moving on to. So we've done the GP's contracts, we've done sort of junior doctors, moving on to dentistry, and I hope pharmacy will come pretty quickly as well.
And £13 million unspent seems crackers, really. Why are they not spending the money?
Absolutely. And again, it's the way that the contract is set up. So that money is sitting there, but the way in which dentists can access it is through what's called these dental units. And they sort of three, it's very complicated, but basically it means that if they deliver NHS services, they can apply for this funding, but the funding that they get back doesn't cover the cost of delivering NHS services, so they just don't do it. So therefore, the money is left and spent. Now, I've been lobbying NHS Devon to change the way that they deliver on the contract and make sure that they provide a bit more flexibility. So they have now done that, which I'm really pleased about. So hopefully a bit more money will start flowing into the system. Some dentists might choose to start delivering more NHS services. But again, this is only a small part of the problem. We do need that fundamental dentistry contracts reform, and that will come next.
I know Labour has announced this morning, we're recording on Friday, a new contract with GPs, I think. So more of that. In terms of hospitals, funding went into Torbay, North Devon, Truro, I think, or was it Derriford? Not Exeter. You didn't ask for anything? You didn't need anything in Exeter?
My understanding from Wanford Hospital is that they weren't, they don't need a big rebuild, they don't have RAC, and so they weren't part of
RAC
that.
RAC is the
crumbling concrete. Yeah. So as far as I was aware, they weren't ever sort of part of that rebuild programme. They're pretty okay. But what they do need is more funding for to get waiting lists down, for example, and I'm really pleased that waiting lists have started to fall now, which is great, from very, very high sort of numbers that we inherited. So, you know, we can get there. But they're also really innovative. So the old Nightingale site is delivering huge numbers of pretty standard operations where you can get people through quite quickly. So they're a pretty innovative trust, I think.
Steve, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is devolution. It's a subject that's dominating our work at the Local Democracy Reporting Service at the moment. Reorganisation of Devon's councils, which is scheduled to happen over the next couple of years. Exeter, of course, has its own plans to become a unitary authority. But how that fits in with the reorganisation, I'm not sure. It may have to spread its wings to cover other parts of the county in order to get up to the population numbers that it needs. It's fair to say it's causing a bit of confusion. What's happening? Why is it happening? And what's going to happen next? And will it work?
I think where it has already happened elsewhere in the country, it has worked. And so what we want to do is push as much power, funding and opportunity out of London, out of Westminster, into local areas as we possibly can. Under the last government, quite a lot of power was sucked up into Whitehall, everything from schools to decision making. You know, I always use the example of Rishi Sunak liked chess. Yeah. And so he wanted to sort of make sure that people could have access to outdoor chess sets. And he said, you know, if you want an outdoor chess set, local authorities, you should apply to me to get an outdoor chess set. And, you know, you get £1,500 for this. You know, this is an absurd sort of concentration of power. It costs more to sort of apply for it than, you know, let local authorities and let local areas decide on their own priorities is my view. So on the local authority, sort of devolution and reorganisation in Devon, we've got a big opportunity to have a more strategic and louder voice for our area than we have had. So when you look at the West Midlands, you look at Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester and those other strategic authorities, they have a real voice at a national level and an international level sometimes when it comes to business investment, where they can really talk on behalf of a large number of people and talk on behalf of business and get those opportunities both from public services and from business into the area. And I think that's what that's what I want to see. I want the maximum that we possibly get for Devon. I would like it to be Devon and Cornwall. The Cornish are a bit more split on whether that is possible. So I think we can still achieve it with Devon. For Exeter, I absolutely believe that Exeter should be a unitary authority. I think it's slightly farcical often that we've got Devon County Council delivering most of the services for Exeter, which is the economic driver of the region. So the leader of Devon County Council is a councillor from King Stainton. He doesn't really have personal interest in Exeter particularly. I think we need to have that unitary authority status for Exeter so that we take our own destiny into our own hands and work out what we need, because we are quite different from the rest of Devon.
I think that the concerns are at the district council level, though, aren't they? You're talking about the strategic authority, mm-hmm. which may be with an elected mayor, but the concern comes more from the grassroots, I think. Communities are worried. I was at a South Hams council meeting a little while ago. People are worried that local communities are going to lose their voice because the authorities are just going to be too big. How can you reassure people that that's not going to happen?
Well, I think that what we don't want is a lot of layers of different authority. which aren't able to deliver anything in particular. So with there's been a huge amount of money taken out of local government over the last 14 years. You know, Exeter's lost something like 60% of its core funding, core spending power over the last 14 years. Devon County Council lost about 40% of its funding. So we need to look at different ways of delivering local government. Some of the challenges and the pressures that have come along around social care, adult social care, SEND in Devon in particular, these are all very, very expensive sort of problems. And we've got these layers of government where there's quite a lot of waste between them, I think. So, you know, if you're in Exeter, when you look at some weeds, they might belong to Devon County Council, some weeds might belong to Exeter City Council. As far as my residents in Exeter are concerned, they don't really care who owns the weeds. They just don't want the weeds to be there. But often, as a Labour city council, we're asking a Devon Tory council to deal with things in our city, and so it's not really working for us. I think in terms of local democracy, I think you would still have local councillors. You know, Exeter might grow a bit. We've got very tight boundaries around the city, despite the fact that quite a lot of the building on the edge, so Cranbrook, Matford, Brook and things like that, those people that live in those areas essentially commute into, commute out of Exeter. They are Exeter focused, but they don't live in Exeter. So I think we do need to expand Exeter's boundaries to make sure that works as well.
But under one of the key proposals, which I think, is it called 145. These numbers are very difficult, isn't it? Which one? Go on, Guy, you will know that. Is Devon County Council, is it?
You put me on the spot now. Number one is Plymouth Plus.
Plymouth Plus, a bit of the South Hams.
We'll take a bit of the South Hams. The four is Torbay, Teignbridge, South Hams and West Devon.
Yep.
Being one authority, and the five is Exeter,
East Devon,
Torridge, North Devon, Mid Devon, and East Devon.
So here we are sitting in Radio X's studio in Exeter, and we can walk 2 minutes away from here into Teignbridge, mm-hmm. 2 minutes away into Teignbridge, and it wouldn't be part of Exeter. This is crackers as well, isn't it?
Well, I think let's wait. Everyone's got lots of ideas about what they want to achieve. We've got to be clear on what the purpose of this is to unleash growth and make sure that cities like Exeter have the ability to control their own affairs and to grow in the way that they are able. And we've got huge sort of sectors around, you know, life sciences, climate tech in the city, and lots of startups and scale-ups. And we're a really burgeoning city at the moment, economically doing very well. But we need the ability, from transport to housing to lots of other sort of areas of strategic sort of authority in the area, that we need to take control of to make sure that Exeter can grow sustainably. So lots of people have got lots of different ideas. There's a deadline for initial proposals, I think, coming up in March. They will go up to the Secretary of State, and then he will start to take a view with a final deadline by November. I would say that, I don't think it would be a great outcome for us to just have two county authorities, sized authorities, with Exeter being subsumed into, you know, a Teignbridge and an East Devon and a Mid Devon alongside Exeter in one authority. I just don't think that would be what the government wants to achieve through.
But they've done it in Cornwall and Somerset.
Yeah,
those councils are.
Yeah, exactly. Exeter is a city that is growing. It's economically diverse and very successful, and we need it to be more so. In terms of the economic impact, it's bigger than Plymouth at the moment. So we don't really want that to be subsumed into a big authority. Cornwall has its own problems with this devolution because it's one single unitary authority already. But it is only about 470,000 people. Devon's about 1.3 million people, so it's a very different situation here.
Do you think this really needed doing, Steve? It's taking an awful lot of brain power, management time, government time, money, I imagine, to do the reorganisation. You say Exeter's lost 60% of its funding, Devon County Council's lost 40% of its funding. Why not just give the money back?
Well, wouldn't that be great?
Lots of money doing this.
Yeah, what we want is to make sure that we're not just... Listen, when Andy Burnham, who is the strategic mayor for Greater Manchester, knocks on the door of Google. They will listen and they will meet him and they will talk about whether they want to invest in Greater Manchester. When you know, other strategic mayors do the same, that will happen as well. When they want to go to number 10, number 10 will see them. With the greatest will in the world and with the greatest respect in the world, when the leader of Devon County Council wants to do that, that is not going to happen. And so what we need is the power and the sort of mandate of a strategic mayor to really set a vision for the region. I think it's what we've lost in what we haven't had in recent years, because we haven't had that strategic leadership.
We're recording on Friday morning, so forgive me if you're not able to answer this, but by the time people listen over this weekend, Angela Rayner will have made an announcement. Do you know what's in that announcement today?
I don't know,
right.
Actually.
So she's we've had on the news as well. Angela Rayner will be making an announcement in a speech today to tell us something. And by the time you're listening to this, you'll know what it is. But we don't.
As will I.
Well, there you go. On that bombshell. You've been out of the country this week, Steve. You've been in Ukraine. You're just back from a visit with a cross-party group of MPs.
That's right.
Including another Devon MP. Torbay's Steve Darling was there as well. You asked the Prime Minister to reaffirm the country's support for Ukraine and for the people who've come to settle in places like Exeter as a result of the Russian invasion. You did, when you were speaking in the Commons the other day. Where do you see this going? Can we afford to increase defence spending if it comes at the expense of things like dentistry, buses and hospital waiting lists?
Yeah, well, I think on that point it's clearly not, because we're already sort of improving. We've put more money into buses, put more money into dentistry and put more money into the NHS, £22 billion over 2 years. However, the first job of any government is to defend the nation, defend its people. We fundamentally underinvested in defence over many years now. There's been some successful programmes, but overall, the Tories had a cut down to about 70,000 for the army, for example, which would be an historic low. We are already in a period of real instability in the world. There are countries out there who do not share our values, who do not share any sort of sense of democracy, liberty, and sense of fair play or sense of application to the rules-based order, which does protect us all. Russia is the key player in that. When you look at the Russian invasion, full-scale invasion of Ukraine, it was simply because Russia did not want Ukraine to exist as a country. It did not want Ukraine to take the decisions that it wanted to take about whether that it wanted a European future. It wanted to be part of the European Union. Eventually, it might want to be part of NATO. It wanted to be part of NATO, by the way, because NATO is a defensive alliance that will protect countries against invasion by Russia. And I think, you know, when you look back, they were very right to want to be a member of NATO in reality. So yes, we absolutely need to invest in our armed forces, because we have to be ready for what comes next. I'm absolutely convinced that if Russia is allowed to succeed in any way in Ukraine, they will not stop there. And we mustn't forget that they're already shipping in North Korean troops to fight on their side in Europe, with presumably the tacit approval of the Chinese. The North Koreans would not do it without the Chinese saying so. That links it fundamentally with Taiwan. And when you consider that 73% of all goods manufactured in the world are manufactured in that sort of part of the Pacific region, that has a real impact on us here. It might feel like it's quite far away, but it's not. It has a significant impact on our lives here.
Things are happening very fast, aren't they? The world is changing incredibly quickly since the inauguration of the president of the USA. Things have just escalated, haven't they? So where did you go in Ukraine? What did you see and what have you brought back with you?
So we took the night train over to, and this is very cross-party, because there were four of us four to a couchette in the night train to to Lviv. So many MPs cuddled up together. Jenny the dog did not come to Ukraine because that wasn't deemed to be not safe for Jenny the dog, Steve's assistant's dog. So we took the night train to Lviv from Poland. We met the mayor of Lviv, who was a fantastically charismatic guy, some great ideas for what he wanted to do. And I think Lviv is very far from the front line, but they really felt like they wanted to be part of the effort. But also, you know, I went to the major graveyard for soldiers from Lviv who died, and, you know, three or four people are being buried there every day. I witnessed you know, people, women, mothers and wives sort of sitting by the graves of their recently deceased husbands and children and weeping. And, you know, it was incredibly moving. We went to see a rehabilitation centre outside of Lviv, funded by Overseas Development Aid, and that was helping veterans who'd lost limbs or who had PTSD and otherwise to be rehabilitated, which was really gratifying to see, actually. And those who could go back to the front lines often expressed a wish to go back to the front line, and in large part it's because their families and their towns are behind Russian lines. They are fighting for the survival of their country. We mustn't forget that. I then went to, we took the train to Kyiv and participated in the what's called the YES conference, which they have every 6 months, the Yalta European Security Conference. I participated in the International Memorial event behind Zelensky and Trudeau and Ursula von der Leyen, and laid a candle at the memorial for the fallen. I think the thing that we met lots of politicians from across Ukraine, from lots of different parties, lots who are not a part of Zelensky's party. And actually, we went into the Rada, their parliament, and they had a vote about whether they should have elections. And they unanimously said no. So all of the parties, there are many parties, they've got a very vibrant political sort of democratic scene. They all voted no because it's impossible to run an election when 20% of your country is under occupation by the Russians. How can you run an election? You can't run a national election. So I think what was most impressed upon me is two things, I think. First, their absolute resilience and pride in their country, and they are doing fantastic work. They are the only army in the world that's deploying over 1.5 million drones a year in a defence and offensive capacity. There's huge amounts that we will be able to learn from them. And second, they were deeply thankful to the UK. We have, and I think this is what's been great about the cross-party consensus in Parliament across the country, actually. You know, whenever I go to, you know, Doddis Cumley or Central Exeter, I see the Ukrainian flag flying somewhere. And that's helped us in Parliament to maintain a unanimity on this, because it is so important that we stand by Ukraine, because they are dying essentially for us. You know, they are defending democracy in their country to stop the Russian invasion from coming to the borders of Poland. I thought, just one final thing, I landed, went to Rzeszów airport, and the one thing you notice is 20 Patriot batteries all pointing in one direction, and that's towards Russia.
And this, to bring it home, this is a 2-hour flight away, isn't it? This is on our doorstep.
This is on our doorstep. This is on our continent. This is a major war involving millions of dead on our continent, and we have a responsibility. If the continent destabilizes so much, and Russia then says, "Well, we got what we wanted in Ukraine. Maybe not all that we wanted, but we essentially split the country. They can't join NATO. They can't join the European Union because it's a frozen conflict, because we control half the country. Where next? What about Estonia? What about Latvia? Finland. What about Finland? You know, Russia has a playbook. It had a playbook in Georgia. It's had a playbook in Moldova. It's had a playbook in Ukraine. We've got to wake up to that.
What were normal people who were meeting you, Steve? What were they asking you, and by definition, the people of the UK, to do?
I think normal people wanted, they genuinely were so thankful to the UK. Like, they really love the UK. They love the fact that we've never sort of vacillated. We've never been sort of on the one hand or the other. We've often been at the forefront of moving to the next technologies. If you remember in the initial days when the columns of tanks were moving towards Kyiv, It was UK Javelin shoulder-borne missiles that were sort of stopping the Russian tanks. We should remember also that there's been tens of thousands of Ukrainian troops that have been trained in the UK. So we launched Operation Orbital after the Russians first invaded in 2014, Ukraine. And so on Salisbury Plain, I've got friends who've been sort of involved in training the Ukrainian troops. So we've been working hand in glove for quite a long time now, actually. And they are very, very thankful for everything that we've done for them. They don't want to be sold out. I think that's the main thing. We cannot have a peace that doesn't last. You cannot just freeze the conflict and allow Russia to rearm and reinvade in a couple of years' time, because that would serve nobody any purpose at all. And Vladimir Putin cannot be trusted, and we should always be aware of that.
In the euphoria for Labour of the election last July, it hasn't all been sunshine and rainbows ever since.
Nope.
A couple of things that keep coming up in council meetings that we cover: inheritance tax, the fears of the farming communities that they'll be badly hit by the changes in the way that's collected. I know Labour says not many farms will be affected, but farmers do tend to say they don't believe that's the case. Families say they'll have to sell farms that have been in theirs for generations. Will the government stick to its guns, or has it got this one wrong?
I think the government will stick to its guns on this. I think that when I talk to lots of different organisations, that many will say that the vast majority of farms and families won't be affected, because you will simply change the way that you plan and you will hand over your farm free of inheritance tax before the deadline. At the end of the day, the inheritance tax, if you do have to pay it, is still far less than anyone else pays in inheritance tax for their businesses or their personal belongings. So there are huge subsidies continuing with this. And let's not forget that we're putting in £5 billion of subsidy over 2 years into farming in the UK too. We absolutely value farming agriculture in this country. I think, you know, obviously in Devon and the Southwest more broadly, we are one of the main bread baskets of the beef baskets and various other things of the country. And so, you know, it's a really important way of life, but also important part of the economy for us. And there's huge amounts of technological innovation going on as well. But I do think that it seemed slightly, when everyone else is sort of shouldering a burden to try and fill the £22 billion black hole that we inherited, and we've really got to get the economy back running properly, that we did need to do some of these more difficult decisions to get the economy going.
I should declare an interest, Steve, here, in that I'm a board director of the Devon Chamber of Commerce, and you will be aware one of the big concerns of businesses comes in about 6 weeks' time, when national insurance contributions paid by employers goes up by about 15%, I think, isn't it, from 13.8% to 15%. And the increase in the national living wage, on top of the increase last year and the year before that, is costing businesses here an awful lot of money, and many of them might not survive.
So what the government is trying to do is probably something that's not been attempted since about 1945. So it's trying to do three things all at once. It's trying to stabilise the finances. There'd been an awful lot that was promised that was unfunded. It's trying to grow the economy at the same time as that. And we're also trying to fix public services at the same time. Those are three very, very difficult things to achieve. We're doing that within the context of GDP to debt ratio of about, debt to GDP ratio of about 97%, so quite high. And we're also doing it in a globally quite destabilised environment.
Those are taxes on business, Steve, not taxes on individuals. Do you think the Labour Party hemmed itself in by saying, we're not going to raise money from the taxes individuals pay, income tax, national insurance, VAT, encourage people to vote for them, and then think, goodness me, we need to raise something? Or you knew in advance you needed to raise more money, so you go after the businesses?
Well, we made the promises before the general election not to raise taxes on people, on individuals, not to raise taxes on your payslips, which is a promise we've kept. So at the end of the day, we've got to stabilise the finances. We've got to find some new money from somewhere. So yes, it's been added to National insurance contributions on business, but it's also within the context that people are already paying the highest tax burden that they have since the 1960s. So we felt that we couldn't and didn't want to raise taxes on individuals because people are already feeling that they're paying a lot of tax anyway. So difficult decisions. You know, no one is saying that this was an easy decision or that we wanted to do it. But I think we've got to remember that we're still paying for COVID, for example, so a huge amount of government spending.
We've only just finished paying for the First World War. It doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't feel like it. You can borrow money.
Well, you can only borrow money to a certain extent until the markets decide that they don't trust that you can pay it back or that you've got a plan to pay it back. And that's the problem we had with Liz Truss, for example, who decided to just sort of say that she's going to cut taxes by something like £60 billion. And then we saw what happened with that. So you can't just do whatever you like for as long as you like. You've got to have a plan. You've got to have confidence in the system because if you don't, mortgage rates go up, food prices go up, and that is bad for people as well.
Now, I'm going to hit you with another one now. It's a lovely day out there, Steve, but it's still pretty chilly. And the changes to the winter fuel allowance really did go down like a lead balloon. I imagine that your inbox was pretty full of people complaining about that, and you'll have heard a lot about that on the doorstep as well. Is that something the government needs to look at again before next winter, or is it a matter of getting people to claim what's due to them?
I think it's a matter of getting people to claim what's due to them. I think we need to get as many people onto pension credit as possible. Pension credit is the gateway to all of the benefits that pensioners are able to access. So if you're not claiming pension credit and you think you might be eligible for it, then you should do so. Winter fuel allowance, again, a very, very difficult decision to take. But as a universal benefit, everyone from Paul McCartney on down got the winter fuel allowance, and in these times that did not feel like a good use of public money. Remember that those people who are on pension credit still get it, and then we put a lot more money into the household support fund, another 700 million I think into the household support fund,
what does that fund do?
So that is for people who are essentially might be struggling with cost of living. So it's allocated to councils, and then councils allocate it to individuals. So you can apply for it. It's not just for pensioners, but it's for anyone that might be struggling with cost of living. But that includes with energy bills. But overall, we're clear that we want to bring energy bills down. The main problem is not the fact that we're taking away their winter fuel allowance. The fact that people can't afford to pay their fuel bills, and you know, energy prices are incredibly high in this country, and that's what we're trying to do to bring them down over in the long term, so that people don't have to be subsidised to pay for heat their home.
So by next winter, possibly there's some success with bringing the actual price of the fuel down.
Well, I would hope so, but I think it's a slightly longer term aspiration that, you know, we need to gain our energy independence so that we're not subject to sort of price shocks from around the world, such as when Russia invaded Ukraine, and then we had to sort of kill the Russian gas coming into in Europe because that was funding the war machine. But I think that the money that we're putting into the energy sector in this country to make sure that we get we want to quadruple offshore wind, triple solar, double onshore wind. The electrification of the economy is already having a huge, huge impact. And I think we can bring down bills over time for sure.
You've been listening to Exeter Labour MP Steve Race. Thank you very much, Steve. Hang around. We'll talk again in a moment. You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available from your regular podcast provider.
Devoncast Radio is the speech station from Radio X.
And we educate and give people advice so they can make informed decisions about their finances.
And you could be on it.
Devoncast reports on the big decisions and the small ones that affect our wonderful county.
With your podcast broadcast to Devon and professionally produced at Radio X.
And then obviously COVID happened, and within COVID it completely changed the dynamics of children.
Find Devoncast Radio on digital radio or on the Radio X app.
Now, to councillors behaving badly. Between us, the members of the Local Democracy Reporting Service team in Devon cover 11 councils, and they're all different. People often ask what they're like. In all honesty, they vary wildly from one meeting to the next. Every councillor, as we've just said, is doing the job because he or she wants to serve the community in which they live. Councillors stand for election because they want to make a difference and because they care passionately about the places they serve. But sometimes caring passionately can make things a bit lively. Torbay Council recently had an 8-hour standards meeting to discuss the findings of an independent inquiry which followed remarks made after a bad-tempered council meeting. And it cost a great deal of money to get us this far. Some say £15,000, the official line is just under £10,000, and the repercussions are still being felt. Just up the road at Teignbridge, another independent inquiry has been conducted after a catalogue of bad behaviour in the council chamber. There's been shouting and swearing, people switching off one another's microphones. There was a physical confrontation between two councillors a while back, and a meeting had to be suspended after one outburst of foul language. Some say the behaviour is intolerable and must be brought under control. Others say it's about exercising free speech in a setting where the issues under debate are so important that the bad behaviour bar just has to be set a bit higher. Councillors all over Devon are watching with interest, especially as some of these volatile councils may have to merge with one another under the Great Reorganisation. Here's Richard Keeling, the Liberal Democrat leader of Teignbridge Council.
There is a problem with some councillors that are, I would say, over-enthusiastic and aggressive.
And here's independent Teignbridge councillor Jane Taylor, who believes her forthright views and strong opinions have put her in the spotlight.
And I've no doubt that I'm seen as part of that problem. But you know what? I own my behaviour because I was elected. I was elected so that I could represent those people who voted for me in that chamber. And I have a right to free speech. But every time I try to speak, I get shut down. And when you get shut down, you get very frustrated.
Ironically, the meeting at which Teignbridge Council discussed the issue was itself pretty bad-tempered, leading the council's monitoring officer to tell members that this was just the kind of thing that had got them into trouble in the first place. And thanks, by the way, to Miles Davis from the BBC for coming to the rescue with those interviews when my recordings didn't save properly. I'm blaming the technology, but I suspect it may have been operator error on my part. Steve Race, Exeter's Labour MP. We were talking about behaviour in the council chamber. I was lucky enough to visit Westminster a couple of weeks ago. And during Prime Minister's questions, there are clearly politicians whose views are completely at odds and who wouldn't be on one another's Christmas card lists. But you have to keep a certain amount of decorum. How on earth do you do it?
You absolutely do, and mostly you do it because there are rules of engagement within the Commons. We all speak through the Speaker, for example, and the Speaker keeps us in good order. I think the vast majority of people will probably only see PMQs, which is by far the rowdiest session you will ever see in the Commons. In reality, for example, in the Ukraine debate yesterday, there was quite a lot of unanimity across the House. There's a lot of agreement across the House, including... Actually, when you look at debates that don't have unanimity, for example, the assisted dying bill debate that was in the House a couple of months ago now, there was a very strong set of views on both sides of the argument, but were expressed in very dignified and thoughtful terms. And I think that the House of Commons does that very well, actually. And it tends to be quite a less rambunctious place than people otherwise imagine.
You've been involved there for quite a long time, though. So has behaviour got worse, or is it just... It feels as if in society, with social media and what have you, that people are less tolerant these days. Do you feel that's happening?
No, well, I think that is happening outside. I think it's having an impact. Quite a lot of the new intake when we made our maiden speeches all referenced the ability to disagree well. And I think that the general election campaign and being involved in politics in the age of social media as it is now has made people realise that ability to debate but not to fall out is very important. But I think you're right. I get quite a lot of, I wouldn't go so far as say abuse. I'm pretty lucky. We live in a good city where people are generally pretty well-mannered and polite. I get a few people who are a bit, they're a bit obsessed with me, to be honest. They're always the first to comment on anything that I ever do with witty one-liners and things. But I know that if you're a woman in politics or if you're a person of colour in politics, then you get a lot of abuse on social media, more so than I do, which I just don't think is very good for democracy or society at all, to be honest.
And has the atmosphere changed when you're having a surgery or when you're out in the street, if you're on the stump or whatever, if you... Do you have close protection now? Because obviously there have been incidents where MPs have been attacked.
That's right. In fact, we've had incidents where MPs have been murdered. If you remember the last couple of years, Joe Cox and David Amos, for example. I have access if I want to. We do. It's not close protection; it's private security. You can get them for a session, and depending on the individual circumstances, MPs will use that or not. I have used it once, but tend not to. It's certainly not in Exeter.
Steve, stick around. We'll talk again just before you leave. But Devon Cast Alison Stevenson has been talking to the people behind a new railway station project on Dartmoor. Here she is, joining members of Devon County Council and West Devon Borough Council as the first turf is cut.
Work has begun on a new railway station on the edge of Okehampton. The £15 million Okehampton interchange will take just over a year to construct and will be the newest addition to the Dartmoor line. Regular passenger services between Okehampton and Exeter returned in 2021 and have exceeded all expectations, with 250,000 people travelling on the line in the first 12 months. The new station at Okehampton Business Park, funded by the government with contributions from Devon County Council and West Devon Borough Council, will be in addition to the town's existing railway station, which has limited parking capacity. A 200-space car park will be provided at Okehampton Interchange, and motorists will be able to get easy access from the A30 and avoid driving through the town centre. The station is expected to get more people travelling by rail from a wide catchment area, including Torridge and North Cornwall, boosting the local economy and improving the environment. I attended the turf cutting ceremony this week in a wet and windy Okehampton with Devon County Council Chairman Councillor John Hart and leader of West Devon Borough Council, Mandy Ewings, doing the honours. Here's Councillor Ewings to tell us what she thinks of it all.
It is just amazing. I first moved here in 1985. This was only ever hoped for. We didn't even have a bypass in those days. And commuting to Exeter was really a hard slog. The job opportunities it's opened up for younger people who can just get on the train every day and either go to Crediton, Exeter, to be able to go to work every day or to go to university, but not have all the costs of university by being able to still live at home. You know, that is an incredible difference to a young person and ordinary families' lives. That it is something's more reachable, which is very important. Tourism, you know, for people to be able to come down on their bikes and walkers and things, it is just a great opportunity, you know, that you can go around some of the smaller tracks once you get into the main part, you know, like get to Exeter and then you can go on all the different side tracks. To be able to go and have a few days walking in that area or taking your bikes, it brings more opportunities for tourism, which we have to get smarter at how we encourage people to come down here and to use those trains.
So you ideally would like this train line taken all the way down to Tavistock, then to Plymouth. You may well have the Tavistock to Plymouth line next. That's still up in the air though, isn't it?
That is still up in the air. I've talked to Bogdan Lupu today from Network Rail, and he said it is still going to be discussed and decided upon by the end of March by government. It is still at the Treasury. There's nothing anyone can do now to boost the case for or against. It's just with the government and we have to wait for an announcement.
So in your lifetime, would you like to see this whole train line, this whole northern route linked up from Plymouth to Exeter?
Oh, I would love to. I really would. I'm not sure it will in my lifetime. I hope the Tavistock to Plymouth bit will. But they have to realise with climate change, etc., Dawlish is not safe. And they do need to look at a non-coastal route from Exeter down into Cornwall, because every time there's a bad storm, the route closes at Exeter. That's Cornwall closed off as a county, and that is not good. It's not sustainable, and it's not good for business or tourism.
Councillor Mandy Ewings there. Chairman of Devon County Council John Hart said the Dartmoor line and the new station was great for the town, Devon in general, and Great Western Railway.
It's opened up Dartmoor in a way that I don't think people really envisaged. The first year, I understand, there was over 300% more people using the train than was anticipated. And it's still growing. They're now talking about putting a third carriage on the journey, because there are so many people trying to get on the carriages at the present moment, it's almost overloaded at times.
Now, this started off as a restoring your railways project, didn't it, in under the Conservative government. What do you think Labour is going to do with putting money into railways into Devon in the future?
I think any government has got to look at the future and realise that the road network can't cope, and therefore the rail's got to come back. It is ironic that my wife used to come to Oakhampton on a steam train to go to the grammar school there, because she passed the 11 plus in rural North Devon, and the only way you could get to a grammar school was by train, or if you were really remote, you boarded. And Oakhampton and Crediton both had boarding houses, as well as day trips. And the train was the equivalent of the bus of today. If you missed the 4 o'clock train going back to Holsworthy, you then had to wait till the 6 o'clock train. But there was a regular train service, and it was used. Yes, we all went away from trains. We went away from buses. But now we're coming back to this transport again.
Do you think, though, with times change, do you think it can ever go back to people using the railway more than their cars? And do you think it's likely that there will be other branch lines linking up in the future, say to Bude, for example?
Now, that's a question. There is a move in Devon to get the train from Oakhampton to Holsworthy and Bude. There's a bit of a Barnstable request as well. There's a desire. There's a difficulty with some of them. The real success of Oakhampton was keeping the line there in the first place and using the train occasionally on it. Most of the other lines don't have railway tracks down. And in many places, the railway line track has become a cycleway or some other recreational facility. I can't answer for the rest. What I do know is that over the next X number of years, the number of cars in this country is supposed to be increasing. They want everybody to go electric. I don't think there's electric capacity yet in this country to cope for the demand that's likely to come. You could make a case for a lot more of these trains. The next one, obviously, is Tavistock to Plymouth. But it won't be easy because, as I say, the route is different. Meldon Bridge would need to be re-examined completely to see if it could take us to a train now. But it's just ironic that, as I say, when my wife went to school, in your last day of your school year, of your school life, you always, when you went over that bridge, you threw your hat or your cap into the viaduct, off the viaduct and into the valley there. If you go down there and wander around, you may still find some old hats and caps for Oakhampton Grammar School.
Councillor John Hart there, who hopes there'll be more train lines opened up in Devon. Both Network Rail and GWR said the Dartmoor line and the new station would never have happened without the whole community and councillors coming together. It all started with the campaign group Oak Rail, founded by Dr. Michael Ireland, which started campaigning for the rail to return to the town back in 2008. GWR's head of strategic development, Matt Barnes, who was instrumental in reinstating passenger services here, has the last word.
I literally put my neck on the line when I claimed in the business case how many people would use this line, and we've been proved right over and again, which has gone a long way to unlocking decisions in the wider South West, other projects, the Mid-Core Metro, etc., with government, because you can point to the success here, which is, you know, been hugely significant, because we were making the case for the line reopening right in the middle of COVID, and actually now we're in a totally different environment where people don't talk about how few people are using their trains. They're talking about success again. Which is brilliant. But in the meantime, this line has been vital.
Matt Barnes there from GWR. Between 50 and 70 people would be working on different shifts over a 24-hour period for the duration of the new station construction and staying in local guest houses and B&Bs. This in itself is expected to be a boost to Okehampton's economy. So, it's full steam ahead, and we'll be bringing you more from Okehampton Interchange as the work progresses.
Now to East Devon, where our colleague Bradley Gerrard witnessed an unusual turn of events at a planning meeting, with one councillor claiming she'd never seen anything like it in 30 years.
When is a planning decision not a planning decision? Well, East Devon District Council's planning committee has found itself in the unusual position of having one of its decisions on a major application for up to 130 homes in Seaton put under review by the council. The committee voted 6 in favour of approving the application and 6 against it. Chair Ollie Davey was in the rejects camp initially, but then subsequently changed his mind to vote the scheme through. Now the chair of the planning committee does have a casting vote, but there's uncertainty whether he can change his mind after a vote has been taken. Councillor Davey did cite reasons why he would be minded to refuse the scheme. However, these were analysed after the vote by planning officer Wendy Ormsby. After her assessment of Councillor Davey's reasons, he said she seemed to be telling him that he doesn't have a leg to stand on regarding his reasons for rejecting the scheme. And this is what he had to say next.
In that case, I think I better withdraw that, which comes a big disappointment to the audience and accept the officer's recommendation, since I don't think I can support the arguments for refusal.
So, are you confirming then that your casting vote is in favour of approval?
I think, given those points that have been made, I think I'm going to struggle to support refusal. Given that it was a split vote and left me with the casting vote.
That caused hubbub from the public gallery, where Seaton residents were listening to the application being debated.
Let's leave comments out of it. We've got a very difficult decision to make here. We've got a split view of the committee. Sorry, I'll have to ask you to clear the gallery if you can't refrain from shouting out. Can I ask you either to keep quiet or to leave, please? This is a difficult decision for the committee, and we are split on it. I hate having the casting vote, and I do usually support the officers, but I just had some reservations about this one.
And there was some reaction from members of the planning committee too, notably veteran councillor Eileen Ragg.
Councillor Ragg.
Chair, all the information has been available. We should all read it, and the vote was taken on that basis. Nearly 30 years, I suppose, on planning committees, I have never encountered anything like this before. Once a vote is taken, that is final. I don't know whether that can be... In fact, this is a decision-making committee.
Councillor Ragg.
It can't even be changed by full council.
But the council's solicitor, Damien Hunter, tried to clear things up.
Councillor Ragg, taking on board your comment, Councillor Davey said that he was minded to use his casting vote to vote against the proposal that was put forward by Councillor Barlow. He's now changed his mind, he's using his casting vote then, so we won't take the vote again. You are correct that the vote was 6 in favour of the approval, and now it was 6 against, but now he's changed his casting vote, so it now will be 7 in favour and 5 against. Thank you very much, there's no further vote.
Never legal, Chair, I don't believe it is.
And Councillor Davey highlighted that given the strengths of his initial reasons for voting to refuse the scheme had been shown to be weak or difficult to defend in a potential appeal, he felt he needed to change his mind.
Well, I think I'd have to come up with reasons for refusal, and as before, we are struggling with that.
Subsequent to the meeting, though, concerns were raised about the decision. A spokesperson for East Devon District Council said it was aware of concerns regarding the decision. The monitoring officer is reviewing the decision-making process, the council said, adding that it could not make any further comment until that review has taken place.
Bradley Gerrard with his story about that unusual situation with East Devon's planning committee. The audio was taken from a recorded live stream of the meeting, which is available on YouTube. It's important to add that the scheme under consideration was an outline application, meaning that even if it does end up that Councillor Davies' casting vote is valid and the proposal gets passed, the developer will need to submit a full planning application, which will have to be considered by the planning committee at a future date. Exeter's Labour MP Steve Race has been our special guest on Devoncast this week. Thank you very much for joining us today, Steve. I had one question I wanted to ask you before you go. It's that awful question that you get when you have an appraisal at work. Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? And more importantly, where do you see Exeter in 5 years' time?
Well, I think Exeter, where do I see Exeter in 5 years' time? I see that we're already... Listen, Exeter is a fantastic city and we've got some great... potential. We're already fulfilling some of that potential, but I think we can do a lot more. I think my job is to bang the drum and to convene people and to make sure that we get as much as we can for public services and for business investment in the city as we possibly can, including in startups and scale-ups around sort of climate tech and other sorts of new technologies, because I think those will be the jobs of the future that will keep the city thriving. So I want to make sure that we've got as many NHS dentist appointments in 5 years' time as possible. I'd love to see the bus network. When you want to get a bus, it turns up on time and gets you the place you want it to on time. And where I'd, in 5 years' time, hopefully I will have just been through a second general election and will be able to continue my work for and with Exeter.
Steve, thank you very much for joining us today. Steve Race, Labour MP for Exeter. Let's do this again soon. Let's not leave it 8 months before we get back in the studio again. And that's Devoncast, your weekly podcast rounding up all the county's crucial stories and talking to the people behind those stories. Thank you for listening, wherever you're listening and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe and remember that you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. And we'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.